just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
You're my brother, you're my sister.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
Never change.
And you're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Skald's Hall, starting here at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, February the 8th. And this week, we are going to be listening to Cale Judy. He is one of the organizers of the Wolf Mountain Consortium, whom I have been talking about in times past. Well, we finally have him on the show, and he's not here live, but we did record a couple of interviews with him. We got him to talk a little bit about his work, and with a light touch, I edit things up, and we have those all ready to go today. So after just a word or two, we are going to go right into that and listen to what he has to say about his work.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beach Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
Born in Nairobi, Kenya, David Nandi Othiambo moved to Winnipeg in 1977 before eventually settling in Vancouver, where he has written three novels entitled Disabandoned Nation, Kiplaget's Chance, and The Reverend's Apprentice. Disabandoned Nation tells the story of a local jazz singer hiding from immigration officials in a flophouse on Vancouver's east side. Othiambo has called this work, in part, an impressionistic sketch of the disparity between Vancouver's west and east side.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello and welcome, and you're tuned into CITR 101.9 FM, and here we are on Skald's Hall, and we have with us today Cale Judy. Say hello, Cale.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. So, Cale, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a Vancouver resident. Recently retransplanted here from London. I was living there in the UK the first half of last year. I'm a writer, and you know, I'm just getting the word out there. Involved with a great group called Wolf Mountain Writing Collective. I co-founded with my buddy Dave, and I just love Vancouver, love being a part of the community here, and just trying to get some good quality poetry out there.
Yes, and we've talked about the Wolf Mountain Group here on Skald's Hall in weeks past. You're also an alumni of here, aren't you?
I am, yes. Of CITR even as well. I went through the training course here and was close to pitching my own show, but I ultimately did not.
I see. Well, welcome back at any rate. So you're a writer, Cale.
I like to think so, yes.
Well, how did you get started off on that in life?
Well, should we go way back to the primordial beginnings?
I think so. It'll help some of our budding writers out there to hear stories like this.
Well, it's one of those. It's funny because it's one of those things when I hear people talk about how they got involved with their artistic pursuits, and it's one of those things that when I hear people who are successful at something say that they were into it from, you know, a young age, I'm always like, oh, how did you know at such a young age that this was the thing you enjoyed? But I must admit for myself, like, writing was something I gravitated towards when I was really young. I got a typewriter for Christmas when I was 9 years old, and that was in part because I loved the Peanuts comic strip, Charlie Brown and Snoopy was always typing away, so I wanted a typewriter to write some stories down, and So something I always gravitated to, but I, and even to this day still, I always struggled with sitting down to write something longer, more substantial. Still do have a short attention span. It was something that I always found a challenge, but it was something I was drawn to. And I can also relate to, I've had a number of interests that I've had pursued in different avenues, but writing has always been the one I've come back to. And it's where I've sort of planted my roots, if you will, now.
I see. So what kind of writing projects do then?
Well, currently, over the last couple of years, it's been a real fruitful time. Basically have self-published four books. It's two chapbooks and then two more proper books. And the last one I did through the Wolf Mountain Writing Collective. We did a four-book set called Wolf Mountain Presents, and then it focused on four of kind of the core members in our group. But yeah, it's so basically I've been involved with doing a lot of sort of more short-form narrative poetry, I guess I would say. Like I do enjoy poetry, but even as someone who has a writing collective that primarily writes poetry, I don't. It's one of those things that you would think would be more, maybe it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on this, but I find it's funny that in our day and age, poetry isn't consumed more, because I feel like in a more of a short attention span culture where we only have 5 minutes to read something between transit trips or, you know, waiting in line or something you can pull up on your phone, you'd think poetry would have a larger audience than it does now, but it's something that people still, I find, have to really work to gravitate towards, or it's something they really seek out and they have to really want to be passionate about it. But yeah, so involved in some poetry in the last few years has been really great. And then I've also written a short film over the last year that I'm working on with a producer right now, and then I'm also getting started on a novella that we could talk about a bit, but it's in the very early stages, so I'm trying to get that going. But yeah, but mainly I would say short narrative poetry has been the sort of the game of choice the last while.
I see. Well, I might not be the best person to ask about poetry, but I do know from a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Kedrick James, that poetry does indeed have a very limited audience in the modern world. He talks about how even the most successful of Vancouver poets often are happy to get 500 print runs of their work.
Oh, yeah. Like even a guy like, you know, Bill Bissett.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah.
He's, I'm not sure how many books he's, I know he's done many books, but I know even now, I mean, he's been published since, I think, the 70s, and he's still, yeah, it's one of those things where it's, yeah, I'm sure if he got a 500, you know, print run, that'd be big, but, yeah, it's definitely something that you don't do for, you're not going to make a living being a poet these days, that's for sure.
Mm, that's true indeed. So you're working on a screenplay.
Yeah, yeah, it was a, I don't know, I've always been a very sort of intense dreamer, I guess. Like I'm one of those people, it's not like when I hit the pillow, it's not like I have 12 hours of sort of black static and then I wake up and then I just go on my day. It's like I've always dreamed very intensely and very vividly, and I can remember snippets of my dreams usually each morning, but it's strange. It's something that I've had kind of my whole life, but sort of over the last year and a half, I've been working on this. I was inspired by the scene in, I'm sure you've seen Mulholland Drive.
Yes.
You know the scene in Mulholland Drive where there's the two characters who are in the sort of the diner, and then the one character is talking about, I can't remember their names, but he's describing this dream he's had, this nightmare, where he sees this sort of creature behind, you know, this trash bin, and then they go out and they actually see it. And it's just this weird, really creepy, really surreal scene. Sort of like a lot of the stuff he did on Twin Peaks. But I'm a big David Lynch fan, but I'm not like a studier of him, but I just appreciate his work and his aesthetic. But that scene's always really stuck out of my mind as something that I find just really interesting. Like, why is it so creepy and why? It almost has this dreamlike quality to it, you know, where he's like literally describing the dream, but then it's sort of like the feelings of it ebb into the real life. And I was sort of drawn to that, and so I wrote a short film script basically drawn on some of my own dreams and incorporating that into the story of basically a protagonist whose dreams are sort of bleeding into his real life and vice versa. And it's it's been interesting. It's been challenging to write. It's screenwriting is a very different medium from trying to write more prose or poetry. It's got its own unique mechanisms and trying to make stuff fit. It's interesting, but it's been fun, and I've been working with a local filmmaker on. He's been giving me notes, and yeah, it's going all right. So
right, yes, I think that it really must be a challenge. I mean, I know that the written word, for example, is a very different challenge to write than a medium that's primarily visual. And the end product of a film is primarily a visual medium. And so knowing how to write for that is almost a more of an indirect process, I think, than trying to write something that is going to be a text as an end product. And by text, I mean a printed text, a text in the sense that we as a society define the term.
Yeah, it's like trying to, like, you know, when you're writing, you know, a poem or a short story or what have you, you're drawing on really creating strong imagery in the mind of your reader. Whereas when you're doing something like for a screenplay, you're literally crafting the imagery that they're going to be seeing, but you have to create, you know, a scene where you can't describe from either a third person or a first person perspective what the person's thinking or feeling. You have to show that. So it draws on different skills in terms of just trying to communicate something. But so it's definitely, I think even in the script writing process, it's helpful to have it be collaborative, just because, you know, if you're trying to communicate something, it's helpful to have people's feedback early on.
Mm-hmm. And are you collaborating with anyone right now?
No, not really. I kind of have my main writing partner is David Edward Kenny, who's the other kind of half of Wolf Mountain, like the sort of the co-founder with me. We share a lot of work together. We have a monthly writing club that meets at the end of each month through Wolf Mountain, and so we have, you know, young budding writers come out, and we meet at the Main on it's Main and 25th or 6th. It's up there. It's past Kingetta. Just Google it. But yeah, but we meet there the last Monday of every month around 8. And you know, if anyone's listening, if you want to come check it out, feel free. But yeah, I mean, other than sort of sharing work there, I basically bounce ideas off him, and my brother and sister are also quite accomplished writers, so we sort of share things. But primarily, yeah, I'm just trying to get, I'm trying to just generate some content for this novella currently. But yeah, not really working on anything with that. Actually, no, sorry, that's not true. I totally slipped my mind. I am actually doing a collaborative project that's more photography based, but I'm doing it with a couple local guys. This one photographer, Dave Del Nia, and this architect, Brendan Callender, and we're in the process of developing the project now, but it's going to be similar to, I don't know if you mentioned the Main Street Trail project that we did through Wolf Mountain, but Main Street Trail was a project that we did this last, in 2012, in the summer, early fall, where we basically got a grant to do this poetry installation up Main Street in Vancouver, and we did... So far, we've done 9 poems, and we basically spray-painted them on the sides of different buildings. A couple are inside. The idea is you kind of go, and you seek them out as you kind of walk up the street. And so I was chatting with this guy, Brendan. We'd met through a mutual friend, and he was actually working on this project with Dave Del Nia. And then they asked me to come in and help them work on sort of the content for this photography project. So it's still taking form now, but that's been really fun to kind of, and so basically through the Main Street Show project, and they had been inspired from some things they've seen on the East Side Culture Crawl, so we're sort of working on that right now. So it'll be fun to see how that develops. But yeah, definitely having other people involved with a project kind of keeps me producing, because I find if it's just me, it's easy to, you know, like with anyone who's trying to do something creative, be it film or photography or art or anything, you have to sit down and do. You know, there's like that resistance that kind of pushes you, that keeps you from really wanting to do it. You're like, maybe I should do some laundry, or I'll make myself a sandwich or something. It's just like these little things, but it's so, like, when you see, just to sit down and do it can be a challenge. But I find when you are working with other people, or you have people holding you accountable, then it's that simple thing, but it really does help.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned Wolf Mountain a couple of times, and I've already mentioned it on weeks past on the show. How did that get started? I believe it's a story that kind of indirectly involves me as well.
Yeah. We were all in the same class together. You were in the class?
Yes.
This in the fall. Yeah.
Yes.
So the three of us, Brian, Dave, and I were all in this writing class with the aforementioned Dr. Kedrick James. It's the fall of 2010. And Dave and myself hit it off pretty early on. He was living nearby, and we actually found out we shared a lot of mutual friends from years past, and we ended up just sort of sitting in class and hammering ideas back and forth. And then at the end of that semester, we were basically discussing the idea of doing sort of a presentation in class, and there, and we were like, well, why don't we, you know, like do it, you know, take it off out of the classroom, let's do it like at the local pub on campus. So we did a show at the pub. It went great. We had some people performed in class, and some people did it at the pub, and it was great. We had a lot of fun, and sort of from that, the actual name Wolf Mountain didn't come until the following summer. Me and Dave were in another class with Dr. James, and we were basically brainstorming names. Dave came up with the name Wolf Mountain, and we did another show that June, actually on my birthday. And then we did a third show at the end of that summer, right after the program ended. And even then, though, we were trying to make it something more like, it wasn't just for people in the teaching program, but it was like, you know, people we knew who were doing writing or things like that, but creating a space just for people to share things they were working on. And that's sort of how it started. And yeah, basically from then we just did a show, which Brian was at, in December. And I think that was our eighth show, I believe. But yeah, it's been really cool. But yeah, the genesis of it was in the UBC teaching program. So
yes. And just to fill in a couple of gaps for my listeners, Kale and I were in the Bachelor of Education program from 2010 to 2011.
Yeah, an intensive 12-month process.
Yes, which anyone can go out and look up if you're interested in. Yes. So, do you have anything you would like to share with us today?
Yeah, I have a couple pieces I'd be happy to share. I brought a copy of my book from our latest sort of Wolf Mountain series, and it's sort of basically an amalgamation of all the work I sort of did in the last year and a bit. So there's a couple selections from the first book, When We Were Young, a couple from my second book, Red Sparrows in the Telephone Box, and then a couple from my third one, which was a split chapbook with Dave Kenny, called My Half Was Called American Baseball. And and so it's broken up into two halves of the book. The first half is called Bergen Sienna Hills, which is more of an Americana sort of kind of bad boy outlaw vibe, which is sort of the Americana thing is something I'm really drawn to. Just my background is all from the States. My dad grew up in Southern California. My mom grew up in New England. So I've always been drawn to the States and sort of the history there and the feel of sort of like more old-time America, like old diners and sort of, I don't know, something about the plains and just, I don't know, there's a history there and an aesthetic that I really like. And then the second half is called Skull Grounds, which I borrowed from The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. But it's more of a horror kind of fantasy vibe. So I thought I'd read something from each section.
All right. So when we come back here at CITR 101.9 on Skull's Hall, we will have Kale Judy giving us a couple of interesting readings.
Hi, my name is Colin. I worked construction for a lot of years. I was the first guy they called on a new job. Then the pain started. Started real small, hardly could feel it. After a while, it got so bad I couldn't bend over. Couldn't sit, couldn't drive. Every doctor I went to couldn't find nothing. One even said it was in my head. From there, I lost everything. 10 or 15 years went by, smoking weed and whatnot. I don't remember the last years at all. Some people caught me trying to climb over a bridge railing, got me help. Now, with the right meds, we've got the pain under control. I used to think drug use was a death sentence. I got life instead.
This message was produced by Colombian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
All right, so welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM, and we have Kale Judy with some readings. Take it away, Kale.
All right, thank you, Brad. So this first piece is called Stone Rose. It's from my book, Wolf Mountain Presents Kale Judy, and it's from the first section, Burn Sienna Hills. Stone Rose. I gave my love a stone rose. It was cold and beautiful. She planted the rose in a concrete lot in a New York City slum. I would hold my love's hand and tell her how beautiful she was. She would smile and whisper in my ear, her voice spiced with secrets, grown in a garden behind her eyes. We lived in the heart of Brooklyn, above a soul food diner. We could see the river from the rooftop. During the summer, we would sit on the roof and bask in the heat. We smoked cigarettes and listened to Marvin Gaye, High in the Friendly Sky. Sometimes my love would ask about the stone rose. Did you find it in a pawn shop? Was it abandoned in a dark alley? No. I sang a 10-story love song to a gypsy in Central Park. She began to cry and showed me her belongings. She kept them in a burlap sack tied to her back. Why did she cry? She had never heard such a beautiful song. That's a lie. You can't sing. It's a story. Let me finish. She offered me fool's gold, but I refused. She offered to read my palm and tell me when I was going to die. I declined. She showed me the rose. She said it was the best she could offer and told me to give it to my love. And so I did. That's very sweet. It's the truth. I still don't believe you. That's okay. I held my love close, telling her secrets from a world only I could see, a world beneath the city streets where myth and legend run rampant, like wild things. It's sad. Even when things seem perfect, they can shatter under the weight of perfection. Like a dismantled angel wing, I would find her hair in strange places after she left. Long, thin strands of yellow in the corners of my bedroom. You took my copy of Catcher in the Rye. I wish you'd asked. It belonged to my father in high school, and it had sentimental value to me.
So. Thank you very much, Kale. I remember you reading that at the get-together I went to in December, and it was very beautiful.
Thank you, yeah. One thing I try and do generally is have, for the live readings, is have try and pick some appropriate music behind it. So it's almost funny reading it without the music. It's like, but yeah, thanks. I know that was one I wrote actually a few years ago. And it was weird because if I can, yeah.
Go ahead.
I'll talk about the background of it. It was one I had written right before I had started dating, like I'd say probably the one serious love of my life so far. And I had written it right when we had first started sort of spending time together, and it had quite a happy end to it. The ending was different. And then during the time when we were actually dating, she read it, and she was like, you know, I don't think the ending should be so happy. It feels like it has more of a somber end. And so I actually wrote an end for it that was what is basically currently there. And it was weird because that actually became, that weirdly became actually what happened in real life when things ended not so well. And so it's one that I hold, has a very bittersweet sort of appreciation for me, because it was one I was happy with that I wrote a while back, but then having it tied into, you know, sort of personal circumstances always gives it a little extra a little extra edge. But yeah, but I've always been quite drawn to that one. And that one was actually, that was one of my first published pieces. I think that was my second published piece of poetry that was published in the first issue of White Rabbit Quarterly, which was a local sort of literary publication that is now defunct. But it was a good little magazine for the time it was around. Yeah, so I'm going to read another one from this section. And, yeah, I think I've been quite drawn to sort of Westerns. And, yeah, just this is actually, if you're familiar at all with the movie Unforgiven, this is basically a creative synopsis of the first half of the film. But I was really, I really love that movie, and it really bumps me out that Clint Eastwood has kind of gotten a little crazy in his old age, but I think he's a wonderful director and a wonderful actor, whatever his political leanings might be. But this is one I wrote based on Unforgiven, and it's called Big Whiskey. Thunder rolled over Big Whiskey, the Wyoming sky filled with rain, and Mama Wyatt's whorehouse was full of blood. The cowboy with the tiny pecker cut the whore with his hunting knife. She had laughed when he pulled down his pants, so he pulled out his knife and slashed her face 5 times. They were deep, thick cuts. Certainly, she would never work again. He escaped out the window and was pursued by a few of the town's men. The rest thought it was too much bother over a whore. The other girls pooled their savings together, hidden in secret places, and put a bounty on the cowboy with the tiny pecker. The man who was hired for the job had seen blood before, and he would see it again before the task was through, and the whore with the ruined face would have her satisfaction. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a fairly powerful and succinct synopsis of the first half of that movie.
Are you a fan of that movie?
Oh, definitely, yes. It is by far my favorite Western. Growing up, my grandfather was of the generation who would watch movies by Steve McQueen and John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. And I grew up watching the Westerns that were prevalent in the 60s. And I was in high school myself when Unforgiven first came out. And I remembered winning the Oscar. And I remembered really being engrossed by this one more so than I was the ones that had come out when my grandparents were younger, just because of how real everything felt. And I know it's an illusion because it's a film, it's verisimilitude, but still, it had, I think, a more lasting effect on me than the other Westerns from a previous generation, just because the mindset behind creating it was very different.
It really subverts what you expect out of a Western, which is, it's funny, you can watch that having seen all, you know, Sergio Leone's films, or you can not have seen any, but it's still really, it hits you in a pretty powerful way. It's a cool, it's a great film. So I guess to read a couple more, I'm going to read, it's called the Black River Trilogy, so if I can indulge you in listening to sort of a three-parter, but it's, This one was cool. I was really happy with how these turned out. This was based on a series of paintings. The artist was Martin Whitfoof, and I just came across his work online, and I was just blown away because he had these really incredible paintings of this kind of post-apocalyptic imagery of just these animals in different, you know, forms of distress, and they were really violent and, but weirdly beautiful in a really dark way. And I was just really drawn to the imagery, and I just felt like, wow, like I picked a bunch, and then I just tried to write something for each one, just to kind of inspired by the really provocative imagery of what he was doing. And sort of on my mind, I thought it'd be really cool to maybe one day we'll do a, you know, coffee table book and the paintings and some poetry. Could be fun. Martin, if you're listening, talk to me. Hit me up on the emails. But, yeah, so I called So I put three poems based on those paintings in here, and I called them the Black River Trilogy. And the first one is called White Dog. And if you're interested in checking out his work, just Google him, and you'll find him. Just go to his website, and you can check out his stuff. But yeah, so White Dog. The river burns scarlet, black oil twisting its fingers over the surface. The coast burned orange, every tin roof lodging lit up like a jack-o'-lantern. The white dog approached the river with the red-flecked coat, greasy muzzle, face full of reckoning. He drank from the river with a steady gaze on the approaching fire, streaking across the surface, a red stick of lightning. Still, he kept his mouth to the water. He lifted his head, eyes soot black, a hellhound with a kingdom all his own, his crown a ring of fire. And the second one is called Odin's Bowl. The black clouds billow over the harbor, smokestacks in the horizon feeding them gently from the tit of their fire bellies. Surrounded by tired earth, dusty, knuckle-bloody dry, cracked in a thousand places. In a small pool of gray water, thick like mercury, sits a wounded tree, roots stretching into the earth like skeleton hands. A tire swing hangs from a crooked limb, forgotten, watching the heavens burn with unholy fire. Odin's bowl, its thick hide covered in grease, strains against the ropes binding it to the tree, wrapped around the bull's thick thighs, belly, and broad, glorious back. White spears protrude from its hide, all aflame at the tips, a slaughterhouse celebration, a festival for the damned. Its head is lowered to the water, but it does not drink. It sees the flames on the horizon and prays for redemption by fire. And the third one is called The Horse and the Monkey King. Waving a red dress from the top of an old commuter bus, the monkeys call their brothers to Tolliver Square, where they have found a sacrifice worthy of their master. The horse, terrified, is unable to pass, seeing only tiny furred creatures at every turn. It rears on its hind legs, trying to exaggerate its already enormous size. But the monkeys will not be dissuaded. They scamper up the horse's back, carrying a red jerry can. They beckon for the hot coals as they drench the horse's mane with fuel. They ignite a long stick and set the horse alight. Excited by the screams, they are joined by more of their brothers, as the horse shrieks like a human child. All agree, the king will be pleased. That's it.
Well, thank you very much, Kale.
Yeah.
So, how can our listeners out there get a hold of your work if they'd be so interested in doing so?
Well, if they are so interested in doing so, there are a couple ways. I would say currently the best way is to visit Project Space, which is in Chinatown here in Vancouver. They have copies of all of my books except me and Dave's chapbook. They might actually even have that, but yeah, they should have copies of all of my books along with the set of Wolf Mountain books that came out in October. As well, I would say currently the best way would just be to hop on the old Facebooks and just follow Wolf Mountain, and we do sell our books at our shows. We are working on a new website, and that should be up in the next few months. And from there, you should be able to buy all of our stuff online. But currently, the best way would be to either visit Project Space or come out to one of our shows. And our next show is in the development stages right now. And we're looking at a late March, early April 2013 show. So that'll be coming up the next few months. And we'll be sure to let you know so you can let your listeners know when that date does arrive. But yeah, I'd say that would be the best way. As well, you can check me out online. I have a Tumblr. I don't know, blog. Is it just me or does blog just sound? Just the word sounds so bad. I think it's just a bad sounding word.
It's a word that we commonly use here at CITR. A blog, Tumblrs, I think, are just Tumblrs, though.
They're just Tumblrs. It's not. I guess I don't really have a blog. I have a Tumblr. I do have a Twitter. I Twitter sometimes, but it's not really. It's mainly just what I was on my Tumblr. But my Tumblr is sort of a running, a running visual representation of kind of what's going on in my brain. And if you just actually Google me, you'll see some of my other stuff come up from a few online publications, and my writing portfolio is behance.com/KaleJudy. But honestly, I would say just check out my Tumblr, and I have links to sort of all my stuff online from there. But I'm actually working on a personal website as well, which should be done fairly soon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say Project Space, hit up Wolf Mountain on Facebook, and then yeah, check out my Tumblr if you want to find out my stuff.
Yes, and if there were any up-and-coming artists in the area who would want to contact you about possibly being in one of your shows, can they do so?
Definitely. I would say that the best way to just get in touch with us is, come out to a writing club, because then not only do we get a chance to meet you, but it also gives you a chance to share your work. And we're always looking for, new voices, and I'm just sort of looking for, the right fit for whatever show we're doing. We try to have it based around theme. So I'd say come out, and then, we'd love to meet you and check out your work, and we'll figure out a way to get you involved.
All right, so that's Kale Judy here with us at Skull Toe on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you very much for coming down.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Great to be here.
Full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby.
Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And it is about 20 to 2 here at CITR 101.9 FM, and you are listening to Skulls Hall. And we just had Kale Judy in a rather extended interview where he discussed his work, and we got a chance to go back and forth a little bit and hear some of his stuff read out loud. And if you want to hear more of him in the Wolf Mountain group, you can, as he said, hit him up on the Facebook. Coming up now, we have a classic writer who has been forgotten, and I think unjustly so. A couple of weeks ago, I had a reading by Edgar Rice Burroughs on the show. And Edgar Rice Burroughs is a science fiction writer who wrote about literally a century ago. You might know him from Tarzan. You might know him from Princess of Mars, which was named John Carter, so they wouldn't have to title a movie with Mars because Hollywood is superstitious about that for some reason. It could be because they keep making bad Mars movies. Well, anyway, we're going to be talking today about a contemporary of Edgar Rice Burroughs who was just as influential on the generation that came after him in genre fiction writing. And so the generation after him would have been the writers of the 20s and 30s, like H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, E.R. Eddings, Lord Dunacy, those kinds of people. And that person is Frances Stevens, or as she was known in real life, Gertrude Bennett Burroughs. And she's one of the many female writers out there who hid her female name when trying to write in genre fiction. It's interesting. Dorothy Fontana, who was writing nearly half a century later for Star Trek, did the same thing. And to this day, she's known as DC Fontana in anything she writes. And this was a very common thing. So Frances Stevens is a genre fiction writer who was a very big influence, especially on people like Lovecraft and his friends, like Clark Ashton Smith and Robert E. Howard. They were very heavily influenced in her work. She wrote a lot of interesting adventure stories. And I thought that it would be interesting to take a look at one of her more well-known novellas called Nightmare. And so coming up now, we're going to be having a dramatic reading of part of the first chapter of Nightmare. And if you're interested in getting her work, much of it is in the public domain because it was literally a century ago. You can go on and you find it as public domain, or you can buy it. I know I bought it for a dollar or so off of Amazon Kindle. They can be found quite cheaply. And so hopefully this will encourage you to look up more about her and learn something interesting about a science fiction writer who deserves to be remembered.
Nightmare, Chapter 1.
Philip, did you notice that tall, thin man in the gray ulster who was walking up and down the boat deck just before dinner?
Yes, sir. I observed the gentleman. Very aristocratic appearance, if I may say so, Mr. Jones.
Exactly. He never bought that ulster in New York. When we reach London, I want you to look around and see if you can find a tailor who will make me one in the same cut.
Very well, sir. Very good taste, if I may say so, Mr. Jones.
You may. And let's see. I need a few new golf sticks and a dozen new shirts. Why did you pack this automatic in the trunk, Philip? Put it in the suitcase.
Yes, sir. I hardly thought you'd require it while on board the Lusitania, sir, if I may say so, Mr. Jones.
Certainly, you may. No, events requiring a pistol as a stage property are not frequent on a liner. By the way, you never showed me how to work the thing, Philip.
No, sir. The shopman from whom I purchased it declared it simple of operation, but I have not found it so, sir.
Well, find out in London and show me. I never met a burglar, but if I ever should, it would be embarrassing to point a pistol at him and not be able to fire it off. I admire heroes of burglar stories. They're always such efficient people.
Under exciting circumstances, sir, one becomes more efficient. They bring it out of a man, if I may say so, Mr. Jones.
By all means. Well, golf is exciting enough for me. Merrydale and I are going to run over to the St. Andrews Links. It's been the dream of my life to play the St. Andrews, but something has always come up to prevent it.
Nothing is likely to occur, I am sure, sir. Shall I repack the steamer trunk now, Mr. Jones?
Yes. And call me a little earlier in the morning, Philip. I have an idea the weather is going to be fine, and since it's the last of the voyage, I want to make the most of it. What time is it? 11, eh? Well, I'm going to bed early for once and get a good night's rest. Ah, thank heaven for a quiet life, Philip. cribbage and the Times for you, golf and...
Beg pardon for interrupting, sir. But do you want this book packed in the trunk?
Paradise Island. Yes, pack that thing away. Did you ever read it, Philip?
No, sir. I don't care for them impossible stories, if I may say so, sir.
And welcome. Now, I'm 32 years old. I've yachted, ridden, motored, and been about the world a good bit. But I've never had a real adventure in my life. People don't have adventures unless they're gentlemen in the filibusting line or polar explorers or something like that. This modern world of ours is as safe as a church, barring accidents, and they are never romantic. And in a hospital or a beastly morgue. Anybody, I suppose, can find trouble by looking for it, but that's not exactly my line.
No, sir, very bad form, sir, if I may say so, Mr. Jones.
You may indeed. Here, I'll help you with that strap, and then bed. Ragged fragments of cloud raced across a sky where great, brilliant stars beamed fitfully. The wind hurled the wave crests through space, and the air was almost as watery as the wide waste of billows and creaming surges in the midst of which Mr. Roland C. Jones, of New York City, found himself unexpectedly struggling. How it could be that he was here, battling for his life with the stars, the wind raging, the tumbling seas for his sole companions, did not immediately trouble him. He was too thoroughly engaged with trying to get a breath that was not half or all salt water to concern himself with either past or future. The mere physical present was a little bit more than he could comfortably handle. But the fight between man and sea was too unequal. Mr. Jones was a fair swimmer, but not being provided with gills, he found it impossible to get a living modicum of oxygen out of the saturated air, even when the waves did not go clean over his head. Thoroughly exhausted, more than half drowned, he had just decided that he might as well throw up his arms and let the sea have its will of him, when he found himself rising up the shoulder of a particularly mighty billow. For an instant, he caught a glimpse of something dark and huge looming above him. Then he was in the trough again. But only for an instant. Up, up he was borne in a long, swift, surging motion. The water seemed to fall away from under him. He was on his knees in sand, and the receding breaker was trying to drag him back with it. The next wave, however, carried him much further up the beach, dropping him with a vicious thud when it was done with him. Barely conscious of his own efforts, Jones dragged himself along on hands and knees, until he was actually out of reach of the ocean, which had been so unappreciative as to spew him up. For a time he lay still, gasping the water out of lungs and stomach. Then he rolled over and sat up. He felt like a man in a dream, yet the pain he suffered informed Mr. Jones that this was no dream, but a grim, incredible reality. It was not alone the question, where was he, although it seemed pressing enough. But how had he gotten into the water at all? The last thing he remembered was a little, pleasant, white-finished room. A stateroom, that was it. He was in his stateroom aboard the liner. He was on board the Lusitania, and he was going to London to visit his cousin, the Honorable Percy Merridale. And he had, let's see... He had been going over the things in his steamer trunk with his man, Philip. And then he was going to bed. He must have gone to bed, and then... He cudgeled his memory, but failed to beat out one single further recollection back of that dazed, struggling moment when he found himself struggling with the waves. Where was the liner?
While in the water, he could not recall having seen any lights, receding or otherwise. Stare earnestly as he might now across the sea, there were certainly no lights visible other than the stars, which storm clouds obscured at ever-increasing intervals. Where was the Lusitania? And how had he come to part company with her so inexplicably? If the huge ship had melted away from about his slumbering form like a dream thing, instead of the vast steel hulk she was, she could not have disappeared more thoroughly or mysteriously. Only one explanation occurred to Mr. Jones, and even that was inadequate to explain the liner's total disappearance. When a boy, he had been given to the habit of sleepwalking. He had usually slept locked in those days, but had thought the habit long since dead and gone. Nevertheless, he must have risen in a dream, gone on deck, and in some way fallen over the rail without being seen by anyone. What an extremely awkward predicament. Where could he be? What land lay near enough for him to have reached it undrowned? In view of the approximate position of the liner, so far as he knew it, Ireland seemed the only possible answer to the question. Had he been cast up on some portion of the Irish coast? Certainly the only thing for him to do was to get up and walk along this lonely, God and man-forsaken beach until he came to some place where he could get dry clothes and cable his friends in London. His clothes. He was fully dressed, and he examined the garments as well as he was able to by starlight. They seemed wrong some way. They were not his clothes at all, but the clothes of a stranger. Had he, in his sleep, wandered into a neighboring stateroom and robbed some innocent stranger? He recalled that he had been talking to Philip about burglars and pistols. Lightly, it is true, but perhaps the suggestion of that conversation had led him into such an astounding exploit. Mr. Jones searched this hypothetical other person's pockets. But all he brought to light were some wet, useless matches, a small penknife, an unmarked handkerchief, and a little loose change. There were no letters, or anything by which the rightful owner could be identified. By a mighty effort, Jones forced the problem of the clothes out of his mind and fixed it upon the greater one of finding shelter and a means of communicating with London. While he sat there, the sky had completely cleared, and even by starlight he could make out that he was on a long, bare stretch of sand, which curved smoothly away on either side. From the inner edge of this strip, a black wall of rock rose sharply, looming to the stars above Jones's head. This enormous cliff also curved away to either side, forming the line of the beach. Selecting a quarter from the small coins he had found, Mr. Jones flipped it in the air. "Heads to the right, tails to the left," said he. The coin fell with the eagle uppermost, and the castaway obediently started off in the direction indicated by fate. Walking was easy on the smooth, wet sand. The night air was so warm that even in his wet clothes, Jones was not uncomfortably cold. And although the interminable breakers still roared in almost to his feet, the storm had evidently blown itself out. These rushing seas were only the aftermath. Presently, the beach dwindled away to nothing, and the cliff extended itself into the sea in a sort of long, sloping foot of jagged rocks. Mr. Jones managed to feel his way around this point, drenched again with spray and wading through shallow pools of water. He tore his clothes and scraped his hands raw, but at last achieved the place where the beach began again. And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. Just before the top of the hour, we have a couple of community-based announcements. The first one is the Krieber family, Michelle, Michael, and Monique Krieber, are involved in producing an online variety series called Speedy and Stretch. And that stars Michelle Krieber and Natalie Sharp. And you might want to check that out. Episode 3 will be put up on YouTube tomorrow. And why is that so important? Well, I was a background extra in it. And it is also a very interesting opportunity. They are going to be doing more public casting calls for this variety show. So if you live in the Vancouver, the Lower Mainland area, and you are looking to be involved in a creative project, follow one of the Krieber family, and the next time they're filming the next episode of Speedy and Stretch, you might be one of the ones on it. It is an interesting opportunity. Secondly, the Vagabond Theater production of Fawlty Towers is going to open in a few weeks at the very end of this month. February 28th is the grand opening, and hopefully, with luck, we are going to have several cast members on the show in the coming weeks, just before they open. So we can take a look forward to that happening as well. And then finally, if you haven't done so yet, and you are interested in collaborating creatively with people from around the Lower Mainland or from around the world, you might want to check out Lee Tokar's Fan Built Project. And this is a wonderful project where artists of all sorts, programmers, design artists, animators, storyboard artists, writers, voiceover actors, whatever it is you do that might be involved in the creation of animation, if you do any of that and are looking for a way into creating finished products that then go on to be recognized, sold, and well-known, then this might be your way in. The FanBuild project is designed as an alternative to the more traditional studio-based methods of funding and producing animation. And so if you're an up-and-coming animator or writer or storyboard artist or voiceover actor or just about anything, and you're interested in networking together to try to produce something worthwhile and worth your time, then you might want to check out FanBuild. They have a Facebook page. They have a webpage, fanbuild.net. They have several YouTube videos up that explain exactly what it is that they're going to be doing. And so that's going to be a great opportunity for the right kinds of people. And they just received a rather significant grant. So this is a project that is going to be going places. And if you want to get in on the ground floor, they're just starting up. This is a good time to do it. All right. So coming up at the very top of the hour, we are going to be having Tyler and Cam with Radio Zero. And in the meantime, listen easy.